The lambs are sentient, Clarice. In honor of Anthony Hopkins on Westworld, who's the next Oscar-winning actor who should commit to a single season of a big TV series, and what should they be doing?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with Tilda Swinton, who should go on something that looks like a really straightforward legal thing, but then elevate it. You know, kind of like Michael Clayton.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. Jeff Bridges should be on Silicon Valley playing against type.
I'm Matt Patches, and I want to see Nicolas Cage in True Detective Season 3 playing two twin brothers solving a murder.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I would love to see Roberto Benigni as the big bad guy in Game of Thrones.
So a White Walker?
Whatever, I don't know.
I win the throne!
Just Roberto Benigni.
I win
he
the
just
throne!
Stands astride the wall.
The throne is mine! It's my throne!
The enemy was making love all the time.
He walks over the wall just like he's walking over the shoulders of people in the audience at the Oscars. Yes.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 147 for Tuesday, December 6th. Today in 1964, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which is, you know, the Rankin and Bass stop-motion Christmas special that somehow hasn't been turned into a stop-motion movie, but give it time. I'm sorry, not so stop-motion, mocap. Give it time.
Oh, God.
It was the first time it aired. I know. Well, we were thinking about Jim Carrey's Grinch today, and it got me thinking about how Rudolph has managed to escape that fate somehow.
Rudolph's really weird. They did the Honest Trailers of it recently that point out just how weird it is. How, like, they took a song that had, like, a very simple story and made it, like, this weird thing about, like, a dentist elf and an island of misfit toys.
And the abominable
snowman. But, I mean, I get it. Got to pat it out.
Yeah, that's how you get weird things like the Grinch. Anyway, it's Christmas season, time for Rudolph, and time for reviews. That was a great segue.
The gift that keeps on giving.
Who was I reading on Twitter the other day who was saying their favorite part of podcasts is when someone makes a segue and then says, that was a great segue.
I've become self-aware.
Review in the, and not in the plural, I'm afraid. Single review. It's the Christmas and giving season. So listeners out there, please. I, as a member of the tribe, just got my first ever Christmas tree that I bought my fiance. It is appropriately jacked and mangled and strange. But in the spirit of giving, you should leave us reviews. But anyway, I will happily read the one new review we have from Asriel4854. It says, great group of friends. Hi, all. I've never written a review before, but I was compelled to after the recent wedding episode. Whereas I respect your opinions on pop culture, I was delighted to hear the camaraderie and friendship on the special wedding episode. You all clearly care for each other, and it shows. Thank you for your continued opinions and for bringing a smile to my face on a difficult day where I was laid off from my job.
Oh, God.
Ooh.
Oh,
I'm sorry to hear that. I look forward to you all every week. Well, thank you, Asriel4854, and we hope you find more work soon.
That was a lovely review. You can leave us any kind of review. It can be light, nice and heartfelt like that or whatever you want. Just, you know, keep
harsh,
talking to us. We like hearing from you.
And bitter.
What? Don't ask for bitter. I mean, I guess just any reviews.
Don't invite them to be bitter.
Patches, you just bait the internet on this.
We'll get to that. That's it. They go back to being the same. I did everything that I want. I still don't really care what anybody else think. Now I can have anything, I ain't gon' stunt. And I don't feel bad cause I did it my way. And now they all say it must be nice, it must be nice to have them Washingtons on your side. It must be nice, it must be nice to have everybody on your side. It must be nice. So coming to theaters this weekend in five theaters, but surely eventually many more, is La La Land, which
feels like we've been hearing about for ages, probably since it was announced, because it was the reunion of Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone, who, you know, they were in a movie called Crazy Stupid Love that you might be forgiven for thinking was just about them, but it was actually about a bunch of other people. They were just the good part. And it's this very big, colorful, modern-day musical, which is the kind of thing that doesn't come out very often and is really catnip for me. I love musicals. I love those too. I was very excited for this. And it won the Audience Award at Toronto. It won the New York Film Critics Circle Award for Best Film. It's got this incredible amount of buzz around it. And we were just going to kind of talk about it briefly since we weren't going to do a proper review of it. And Patches, I want to start with you because I feel like you are the musical expert
on
this show. Jazz reference.
Yeah. Tell me. Well, first of all, tell me all about why jazz is the only correct form of art. And then talk to me about La La Land.
I was trying to think of a great jazz reference, but I don't know why you would think that I would know one. I'm no jazz expert.
We need Jordan Hoffman,
and that's probably why I kind of raise an eyebrow at La La Land a little bit. I got swept up appropriately in this romanticized musical escapade, this love story, a bit of a tragedy. You know, this Damien Chazelle wrote and directed Whiplash, kind of going back to that same well, I think, about creativity, about what it takes to be an artist and what you sacrifice and what you put out there into the world. And this time it's about more of the romance. I guess in Whiplash you get one scene where he's kind of tragically dissing his girlfriend and saying it's not going to work out. Here it's kind of the...
I would say Whiplash is definitely not a romance.
No. Well, it's more of a bromance, I suppose. But there's hints of that romance that doesn't work out between Miles Teller and what's-her-name who plays Supergirl now. Here it's the whole thing. And at first you think that it's just going to sweep them up and it's going to be them singing and dancing and telling them how much they love each other. And maybe there's going to be just a little diversion to make the third act, you know, tremble, but and then they'll come kind of fall back into each other's arms. But no, this is a much more tragic film than that, or at least introspective about what it takes to be an artist. And Ryan Gosling, as you said, is this, he wishes he could open a jazz club and, you know, throw back as jazz starts disappearing into the musical ether and pop takes over. You know, he has to take a job with what?
Like he didn't start, you know, 50 years ago.
That's true. Well, though, this movie's kind of timeless. It's weird. So it's not, oh God, what is that? Ewan McGregor, Renee Zellweger, Down with Love. Exists in a weird continuous 50s, but, this movie feels like it's taking place in the past and clearly takes place in the present because Ryan Gosling gets swept up with John Legend at some point, a fictional version.
And there are iPhones.
Yeah, and he just hates the present and wishes he could revive the past.
Who doesn't?
Yeah. Well, I would say after this movie, I love the present because actually all these forward thinkers, I kind of stand against Ryan Gosling in this movie. I think he's a bit of a schmuck and on purpose because Emma Stone is another type of dreamer. She wants to be an actress in Hollywood and she sees this old version of Hollywood where stars can emerge in the back lot and be the face on a wall and you dream of them and maybe you can be that one day. And she works at a Starbucks basically on a back lot. And these two have their goals and they mix and mingle and, you know, there's big song and dances, obviously, and that kind of falls away in the middle of the movie to become something more naturalistic and terse and dramatic. And that's when the movie starts not working for me as much. I really like the fantastical bits and then how the dreams and fantasy can kind of fall away when everything you think is going to go right doesn't. But it doesn't maintain that. It can't quite find the tone that it wants to. It wants to have its cake and eat it too, I suppose. And I don't know. I'm probably going to stand between you two because I remember David tweeting out of Toronto that he fell in love with this movie. And if it didn't melt your heart, then maybe you're a worthless soul like me.
I would, Jesus Christ, I would never say anything like that.
I don't know. It's a sensational tweet. I could see you saying something like that, going all in.
Yeah, sensational tweet, but I would never be so fucking basic as to go with one of these. Like, if you didn't cry during this movie, you must not have a heart. Instant block. Louise.
Well, David, I feel like I'm really surprised to find myself, and I can talk more later, but I like this movie less than you, which I never, ever would have expected. Based
it's a crazy 2016, man.
I know. Crazy up world. Is down. Down
Town
is up.
Up. 2 + 2 = 5. Yeah, well, I think Patches may only jive with half this movie because he only seems to get half of this movie. Am I right?
No, wait. I don't understand how that's a diss. What don't I understand about this movie?
No, I will take back such antagonistic rhetoric. I do think that, to some extent, it's a movie about becoming an artist, but I think even more than that, it's a movie about our dreams.
Sure.
Of course, it's artistic dreams in this film, but really about the lives that we envision for ourselves and how we measure our own happiness against them, and then the compromises that we make, the compromises we make to go on, the sacrifices that we make to have those dreams. I think that something that I found very interesting about this movie, which I enjoyed tremendously, is that the idea that it's a musical is a bit of a feint. What Patches didn't love about the movie, I thought, was sort of its masterstroke, which is that it sort of, its musical form disintegrates as the movie goes on. I mean, it's like a full-bore throwback technical or musical for the first 40 or 50 minutes or so, and then you notice that there are fewer and fewer songs, and it becomes more drab, and the next thing you know, you're watching a rather conventional, in a lot of respects, at least aesthetically, indie romance that's a bit dysfunctional. And the movie is undeniably slower and a bit moribund in those sections, but I think it's working towards a much greater point that is hammered home with style in the film's beautiful last 15 minutes. I wouldn't argue that all the John Legend stuff works even on a beat-to-beat level, but I do think that in broad strokes, the film knows exactly what it's doing. I think
it knows what it's doing. I think it understands the choice that it's making. I just don't think it's well-paced or well-constructed enough to kind of pull off the trick.
It doesn't have the going from a... Going from an interesting kind of boundary-breaking musical to a conventional indie romance is not at all the trade that I would have made.
Well, the boundary-breaking, the musical part isn't boundary-breaking at all. The transition is where it breaks the boundary. The fact that it's able to, and has the courage really required to make that transition and to package it in the same movie and then sort of swan dive out of it, and land in the place where it does, I think, is what makes it boundary.
I just wish music could have communicated all of these ideas. If it was going to start there and be such an important part of both these characters' lives, like if that's really the keystone in these people's existence, then why wouldn't it persist even through the darkest times or the most melancholy or the most disruptive? Instead, they seem to abandon their dreams like they weren't that important in the first place, and yet they cling to them. They create these excuses why they can't be together or why they have to change lanes. But music doesn't...
It says about me, but I related to it intensely every step of the way in terms of their relationships with their own dreams and how they put them on pause and how they have to confront the messiness of their existence and their...
No, I think that's fair.
You did have to stop doing something you wanted to do to see Why Him tonight, so I guess that's where it comes up.
I have made that sacrifice. I thought really, as someone who thought that Whiplash was inauthentic in many ways, and certainly as far as my own experience and the way I see the world, I don't know. I really did not care for Whiplash. I also loathe Miles Teller on screen.
There you go. I just wanted to hear Katie kind of stand up, because Katie, I feel like maybe I like this movie more than you. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I really, and I feel like I wanted to love it a lot, and maybe it was a problem coming into it having heard a lot of people talk about it for a long time, which I guess is how a lot of people are going to see it. But I love musicals, and I wanted it to be a musical, and I got really frustrated when it kind of gave up on that and then just didn't have the kind of story to back up what it was doing with it. Like, even in the beginning, when you...
Go on. Well, I was going to ask you to watch it again, not just to challenge your own opinion, but it sounds, the way you framed it, you said that a lot of it had to do with your expectation.
Sure, yeah, and I look, I do want to see it again.
Dovetails with the characters' experiences. So I would be curious, maybe for a future episode, if you rewatched it, and you could say, David, I hate it even more now, or...
I mean, but I got frustrated, like, even early on, like, there's a scene that's in all the trailers where they kind of do this tap dance on this, you know, like, Mulholland Drive above Hollywood, and the way that that is set up in the script, you know, it doesn't totally make sense that they would start dancing together at that moment in the way that they do it. Like, it just doesn't feel like the story is really there in place. So then, especially when the music falls away and it's dealing with this indie drama like you were talking about, I didn't feel like I had the characters or the story or really, you know, the meat of a movie to really carry me through that. And then, you know, it ends with this like really gorgeous musical number, and it's beautiful and so ambitious.
It almost...
I'm impressed by all of that, but it didn't... I kept wanting to be lifted up by it, and it felt like it couldn't... It wasn't good enough to get there.
I found a lot of the material...
Why must you project your wants?
I found a lot of the material that Emma Stone's character was going through, both her songs, her fantastical dream moments, and her harsh reality, to be very organic and very true. And it felt like the Ryan Gosling material was kind of jarring and breaking up this true story, as if it needed to be a two-hander. It needed to be this equal relationship and seeing both sides. But I loved Emma Stone's song. She has a song where she's getting ready to go to the club, which I think is fantastic. She has a song later in the movie about she's in an audition telling a very sad but illuminating story and told through kind of spoken
Sing
word song. I cannot remember. It probably goes, La La Land, you wanna come to La La Land.
Is insulting to Justin Hurwitz and the other people.
City of Stars. Wait, is that how it goes?
Yes.
No, that's right.
Oh, that's right. Gosling's sad sack song. Yeah, I just felt like that was being drilled into the movie, his whole thing about jazz. And I couldn't tell if this movie in the end found him to be a tragic character who was stuck in his ways, or if it was revering jazz as some lost art and that he was really sacrificing himself. It seemed just a
it's
little
made
jumbled.
By the guy who made Whiplash.
Yeah,
of
true.
Course it's revering jazz.
Yeah, but
jazz is a lost
but
art.
On some level you see him resisting it and kind movie. Of indulging in it. I don't know. I just felt like Emma Stone was the true character here, and if we'd spent more time in her perspective, then maybe this would have been more successful. I don't know.
I do think it's critical of these characters. I mean, there are some of the adventures that go on, the jazz club that they go to.
Where I mean, Emma Stone.
Sitting in the middle of the room and surrounded entirely by black people. She's the only white person there. She's dancing with the spotlight. I mean, it's a lot of this stuff.
That's a can of worms.
Yeah, it is. But I do think that the film, maybe not that particular moment is something that will be unpacked for a long time to come. But I do think that the film is not uncritical of its characters and how.
Well, certainly he.
Sort of me first.
Damien Chazelle punishes Emma Stone in the end. I mean, she gets with Tom Everett Scott or something, like in one moment.
Is that who that is?
Yeah, from That Thing You Do.
From That Thing You Do? Oh, believe me, I remember. Okay, one last thing, and maybe we'll talk about this more as the Oscar season goes on.
This is winning Best Picture, Katie, so you're going to have to.
Yeah, I know. No, we're going to talk about
it. I don't know yet.
Okay, I just have one thing for you specifically, David. I feel like you, as someone who's been really canny about recognizing kind of the disease of nostalgia in pop culture and in the world, this movie is so aggressively nostalgic, and not just in Ryan Gosling's character and the way it reveres Rebel Without a Cause and clothing and everything else. And I feel like it's really unself-aware about that and falling into the same trap that, you know, Hollywood in general is, in the sense that there was some better time in the past. It's making America great again, David.
Yeah,
how do you feel
I
about
think
that?
It is the opposite of what the movie is. Or no, it was better in the past. It is quite the contrary. I mean, the characters just have to forge a new future for themselves, and the movie shows the danger of falling prey to nothing but empty nostalgia. And I've never had it out for nostalgia in and of itself, but simply the idiotic, empty ways in which so many people in our profession, especially the ones who cling to Stranger Things era garbage, have let it corrode any sense of creativity or adventurousness. But I don't think that this movie is arguing that point. And it is going to win Best Picture. And,
yes, definitely.
It'll be one of our better Best Picture winners in a long time. As much as I like Spotlight, I think this is a better film than Spotlight. It's a very different film.
We have predicted winners of other contests on this podcast poorly, so we shouldn't sound too confident.
Election, yes. The election, well, she won the popular vote. She won the popular vote. Fortunately, there is no electoral college when it comes to the Oscars. But
that's true.
I do.
Everyone in La La Land wins the popular vote.
I am riding high on my Spotlight call from last September, so.
Yeah, I lost money on that.
You grinning lied. I'd rather be shiny like a treasure from a sunken pirate wreck. Scrub the deck and make it look shiny. I will sparkle like a wealthy woman's neck. Just to say, don't you know, fish are dumb, 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 they chase anything that glitters.
So what can I say except you're welcome for the islands? I can't do it. Moana, I can't sing like The Rock. I'm sorry.
Oh.
Here's what's stuck in my head right now. Away, away is something or another singing. What's it stuck in your head, David?
Two Moana songs, and you don't even get close to the best Moana song.
Shiny? Is it
Which
Shiny?
Is?
Which is... It's the one that George Washington from Hamilton sings about coconuts, obviously.
I really like Jermaine Clement's song, the... shiny like a treasure from a sunken pirate wreck. You know? That's a good one.
That's a good one to sing karaoke. So I saw Moana and I've had the song stuck in my head, so I just kind of wanted to talk about Moana and the songs. Have we talked about Moana at all? I don't think we have.
I don't think we do. What is Moana about for people who haven't seen it?
Have you ever seen a Disney movie?
It's about
a young girl.
A young girl going on an adventure to save her family and find out who she is.
It's so tired at this point.
It does have parent.
It does have what I think is unique, at least for like a Disney princessy sort of movie, where it's a relationship between a young girl and a grown man that's like not parental or romantic. It's just like they're equals. I mean, that's the dynamic in like Finding Nemo and in Zootopia, so it's not like that unique, but I enjoyed that.
We also,
princess context.
You know, this is it's about a Polynesian tribe and she's the chiefess, and that's important, right? I mean, this is representation on screen that we've never seen before, and it might be the driest, most boring story Disney's ever put forth because they've done it a million times, but it's important.
Yeah, and it's like, I wouldn't call it a dry or boring story. Like, it's a story that they've done.
There is a lot of water.
Works every time, especially when there's really good music in it.
Works every time.
And Lin-Manuel Miranda helped write some of the songs, and you can hear him on the soundtrack at one point, which is hilarious to me, because, like, he can sing fine. But the songs I've had stuck in my head, and it's a really interesting Oscars for Best Original Song. Like, I don't know if that dynamic of it interests you as much as just singing the Jemaine Clement music, but... I don't know. Is Lin-Manuel Miranda going to EGOT from this?
Everyone wants him to. Everyone seems to want him to. But I don't know. Why do I find these songs infectious but not fulfilling? Am I crazy?
Because you don't like you don't like the movie.
Yes, that's probably true. But I keep seeing them at home. I did not dig the movie. I did not dig the movie. But I mean, Katie and I, we were talking about how like there's just so many good songs out there this year. There's Sing Street. There's Pop Star.
There's La La Land.
La La Land.
Singing those songs before.
Why do we have to go back to? We just want Lin-Manuel Miranda to win an Oscar, I guess, and he will. Am I being cynical?
You know, a good story in the Best Original Song race works as well as it does in anything else. Also, I feel like Sia has like two or three submissions that she's singing.
Don't even get me started on in the future. The only difference between film and television will be you can tell it's a movie if Sia sings over the end credits. That's the only distinction. And that is where we are heading.
She has a song on Eagle Huntress and in Lion, and I feel
and,
like
and
there's
Sia,
one more.
Sia, who I always thought was pretty talented, her songs for movies are fucking awful.
Like, wait till you hear her Westworld song.
Oh, God. The song, the Lion score by Dustin O'Halloran and Hauschka is gorgeous. And then the Sia song that plays at the end credits and is the first track on the soundtrack album is Balls. It's really unfortunate. Ban her. Go back to making really strong pop music. Stay away from adding the Weinstein sheen to the end of otherwise good Oscar bait.
Yeah, I've seen Lion since we talked about it last week. It's as good as you guys said.
Oh,
I'm glad I watched it.
You're right.
Well, last year's Best Original Song category was so terrible.
What was it?
Sam Smith won an Oscar, guys.
Oh, right. Jeez.
For a really awful Bond song.
Has enough time passed that we can say that as urgent as the message that Lady Gaga song about...
it was a terrible song.
Rape. It's terrible. A terrible song.
Yeah.
All right. I just,
no,
like,
I mean,
it seemed
so like
we couldn't, we had to dance around that once upon a time.
We had to dance to it.
So yeah, there was, it was that, it was Writings on the Wall, it was a Weekend song that was in the 50 Shades of Grey, something from Racing Extinction, and then that song from Youth with the opera singer.
Oh, I love that song.
Yeah, okay. What's nice is that this decade so far has had some really good winners. It had like Skyfall and Let It Go, and like Glory from Selma is not like a classic, but it's a pretty good song. I'm glad that we're coming
song.
Back to
one day
that we're coming
when the glory comes.
I mean, but it's not like, you know, it's not Happy, which was the runner up the year that Let It Go won, which should tell you what a crazy year.
Oh, guys, I watched Trolls.
How was
speaking
that?
Of best, yeah, Justin Timberlake's gonna get an Oscar nomination.
Do you think so?
I don't know. That song is like
on the radio,
a huge hit.
Right. Well, it's the movie is horrible. I mean, the movie is like 18 trolls related short films stuck together. One of the trolls speaks in auto tune only, It is a hard watch.
Why are you putting me back through this? I thought I was done with Trolls. Put me back in. But the genius of Trolls was releasing that song like 8 months before the movie came out, and really letting it take definitely. On life of its own. And then it comes on in the movie, and everyone's like, "Oh my god, I love the song!"
Right. It feels like just another one
totally
of the pop songs.
Yeah. You with it. They incepted the fuck out of you.
Well, Dave, you should be the deciding call here. What is the best song winner of 2016?
Oh, I'm part of Team EGOT, so let's give it to Moana.
Blind stamp of approval for Moana?
Because you can't give an Oscar.
No, it's not blind. I've listened to the soundtrack. I just haven't gotten to see the movie. But I did have to bite my lip when you're like, so much water. And it's like, do you know how much animation time and render power it takes to do just a little bit of water? And you're like, too much realistic water.
I do think there's a chance that La La Land could ride the wave of other. I mean, it's probably the most animated film. So, I do think there's a chance. What's happening?
City of Stars is a fine song, but all the songs from Moana are better.
Damn. I don't disagree with you. I don't know about all the songs. I only think that Moana has like two or three good songs, but that's plenty.
Shiny.
I don't know.
Come on.
Yeah, Frozen had one good song, and you know, they rode that song to glory. But
I think Frozen had one like infectious song and no good songs.
Let's relitigate Frozen.
No good songs.
So many.
I feel like Do You Want to Build a Snowman was, at least for parody purposes, up there with like Call Me Maybe. It's like,
right.
Eventually got bad enough to be good enough to be bad enough to be good enough again.
There will be no Moana spoofs.
Yeah.
Except the one you're about to sing, Dave. Sing it now.
Oh, hey, oh, hey. It's time for the music break.
That was good.
So, what I believe you were trying to say is thank you.
Thank you?
You're welcome.
What? No. I didn't. I wasn't. Why would I ever say
okay,
that?
Okay. I see what's happening, yeah. You're face to face with greatness and it's strange. You don't even know how you feel. It's adorable. Well, it's nice to see that humans never change. Open your eyes, let's begin. Yes, it's really me, it's Maui, breathe it in. I know it's a lot, the hair, the bod. When you're staring at a demigod, what can I say except you're welcome? For the tides, the sun, the sky. Hey, it's okay.
So Westworld has ended. It was no Game of Thrones, I would say, in terms of HBO dramas. I got us all talking.
What does
that
mean? Close.
It was. Hang on. I'm acknowledging that the end of a season of Westworld was not like the huge, huge deal.
It was not Game of Thrones.
It was like our methadone until Game of Thrones comes back in terms of a big, ambitious HBO drama we can talk and theorize about. And it was a good time. The finale kind of, well, first of all, we're going to spoil the finale, obviously. So, you know, if you haven't finished it, finish it. The finale did an interesting job of setting up a potential second season. It kind of threw a lot. It didn't wrap up everything. It kind of wrapped up things in a way that I didn't find totally believable. I honestly can't decide if this is a good show.
Nolan-y right at the end, like I expected it to.
Wait, Dave, what do you mean by real Nolan-y?
Sterile and heady and based on, I don't know, framing strong performances correctly. Maybe not even well, but at least correctly. I think the brothers share that in their, storytelling manner.
All right.
I like it. Don't get me wrong. It's one of my favorite things about Nolan products, but.
Do you think Westworld's a good show?
I think it's a good show because it's a show that encourages active viewing, and it's so much so that it's trying to be like the perfect puzzle box. It seems like it's going to have the breathing room to be a different puzzle box each time. And, you know, if that's well executed, that's fine. It's never going to be Game of Thrones, I don't think, just because its focus isn't
so much. It literally
so
will not be Game of Thrones.
It will literally continue not being Game of Thrones.
I mean, I think I think that Westworld is the best argument for film that I've seen in a long time, because it focus is the perfect word for it. in that the contrast between what the Nolan brothers, I understand that Christopher Nolan is not involved in this show, but I'm going to lump them together because of their work on in the film side of things, that the puzzle boxes that they've been able to make with such care and such perfection in films like The Prestige and The Inception and Memento and also The Prestige are, you see that sort of stretched out in all directions here. And I think everything that doesn't work about Westworld is because of the space that it has to fill. And also, I think because a lot of the ideas are backwards and remedial. But I think that what's... I was just listening to...
But let's not pause on that at all.
No.
Let's keep going.
We'll just accept that as fact.
No. I'm giving you a layup here, or like at least teeing you guys up to run with this. About I was listening to a podcast about transgenesis, and this guy is a bio artist who was talking about essentially genetic modifications in the future and making people and new life forms as art rather than as something that explicitly serves a function, and like trying to move away from eugenics and things like that. But this idea of creation, designing it, and I was thinking a lot about how Westworld, by so fixedly anchoring itself in rhetoric that has already been explored much better elsewhere, specifically in terms of AI, and really just dealing with the most basic ideas, the most basic ideas of ethics. And the major thing the show gets backwards for me is that the first season thought that it was about, or presented itself as about being, about convincing people that robots have souls, when the last episode, which I liked a lot, I thought was a lot more interesting because the show finally realized that it should be about robots learning to no longer have any sort of care for these lesser life forms, the people. And I just think that a lot of the ideas it's playing with about the future of humanity and whatnot are they've found the least interesting routes to get there. But I liked the – and really laboring and – like every single scene in the show is bad.
No.
Every single scene is bad.
No, it's not true.
It's empty.
You're wrong.
It's true. I think as a whole, it can be interesting.
No.
But the characters are all poorly written.
Yes.
They're all they're well acted, but they're all poorly written.
Yes.
They only speak in expository crap. Like they – but I think that like as a whole – I think that it could go interesting places. It just needs to do it differently. I loved how epic this last episode was. I was not expecting that.
I think you're being condescending. I think that you are you're capping this show at the knees because it's not smart enough or it's not taking the most intellectual route when really most people do not think about these topics. Right, no, but here's the thing.
It's all intellect.
It's baseline intellect, and it's ruminating in kind of psychobabble for many people who would never, ever think about this stuff. Like, yes, if you're listening to podcasts about, you know, mutating humans into art, you're working on a different level than most people, and this is...
No, this was... I don't want to give myself that much credit. This was... I was like, oh,
fair. I'm just saying this is.
Wait, this is, and I don't think that's what David was saying at all. It's just that it's like it's so married to all of these ideas. And I mean, maybe this is putting words.
Well, he called it remedial. He called it remedial. So I'm addressing that point that this is it. I mean, on some level, it is remedial. But that's.
I mean, they spent 10.5 hours.
No, I'm saying it is remedial, but that's not a negative when you're dealing when you're using that as the foundation for. Jumping off in lots of different directions about the future of entertainment, the future of robotic technology, the future of identity. And when you're dealing with all of these topics and you're kind of laying tracks to tell a grander story down the road, I don't see why being remedial is bad when you're trying to reach a broader audience and using pulpy material to do it. It doesn't need to be hyper-intellectual. It doesn't have to back itself up like some sort of college thesis.
Like all things, I think if the storytelling were better,
I guess that's where
if I cared more about.
That's where it did it for me.
I didn't think they were just ideas.
I got into the characters. I was really interested in Dolores' path along this maze.
Wait! Stop talking.
All the show was
David, finish your thought and let Patches talk.
There's a delay. If all the show was its ideas, which is what I think it has been so far. Then I really have nothing to judge it on other than how interesting I find those ideas. If it was able to wrap it up in some interesting human drama, which I think occasionally it did with Ed Harris's character, And I like Anthony Hopkins' character a little bit as well, to a certain extent. Then I am like, again, to reframe how we started this segment, I do not think that I have any greater insight into these matters than the average person out there, because I listened to one podcast at one time. I think that if I don't hide, I don't hold the show up to a higher standard. I think it's for that reason that I was frustrated by how
Patches,
familiar.
Go.
No, I was just saying.
Why do you like the characters?
I mean, why do I like the characters? Because I got into the story that it was dealing, that it was beyond just the ideas. It was the ideas and the puzzle making as an empathy tool to understand what it might be like to be this awakening figure, to be this, you know, proto-human as AI. And I thought that was really interesting to, this isn't a story, this isn't like Ex Machina, where we're standing and watching AI develop and kind of beat our asses. We are the robots in this show. And as you come to learn over many episodes, you know, more people than you think are in the same position, are actually hosts, are robots. And the identities blur and the character arcs shift because of all the mysteries and puzzle box. It all has purpose. And I think that's what really got me throughout this series and why I kind of stuck with the characters, why I was interested in Dolores's journey through the maze as both what is fucking happening right now, but also on an emotional level, feeling befuddled and feeling displaced from time and having these memories. I found it to be a very emotional experience. And then with Bernard, you know, what is his life back home and what is his life there? And then how does that change as he discovers more and more about the park? And then I really do, on a visceral level, enjoy the acting in the show, as you mentioned, David. Like, watching Anthony Hopkins and Ed Harris have meaty material that I give a damn about and have time to invest. You know, you're kind of slamming the fact that it's 10 episodes. I'm glad it is. I like spending time with these people, and I like seeing what they're up to on, like, a day-to-day basis. It's kind of so like good. An office procedural or something. It's like a non-comedy version of The Office a lot of the time. It's just kind of hanging out and doing stuff, and I like that.
Wait, I want to throw to Dave, because I mean, one of my biggest problems with Westworld, I think, is that I didn't feel that character engagement you're talking about, Patches, and I really felt like in the finale it did a lot of things with the characters where you kind of look back to where they were in episode 2 or 3 and can't track it at all. And Dave, you talk so much about character and the way that narratives are built in that way. Do you feel like it was successful? Can you talk me into thinking that the way this show is structured on a character basis?
Well, what characters don't you buy?
No, I can't talk you into liking the characters, because what I actually like about this is that it was a show that was completely plotted to resist melodrama. So, like, we're so used to in our, like, prestige dramas with our, like, intense actors that those actors are there to show up and sell you through empathy on an emotion. And here, all of our actors are constantly lying to you through, like, great performances and speaking gobbledygook. And then to a certain extent, the way that they were able to thread a single narrative through all these different issues while sort of, like, hiding the ball, to the point where, like, I was still, up until, like, the last moments, debating if I thought that the hosts had consciousness, just, like, on how they were defining it. And then I didn't realize until Dolores saw herself that I was supposed to be right with the host at that moment. So it was interesting to see something that was built like Lost, in terms of, like, throwing out little side mysteries, but then somehow was able to sort of, like, Gordian knot it all together into a central idea that's like, and now they're conscious, end of season.
Mm-hmm.
Which, even if people had, like, told me that that's what the whole, you know, season was a prelude to what I would consider the Westworld story, I don't think I would have seen it coming in this way, because it resisted letting you into the characters until the very end, and then they just told you what they were thinking. And as somebody who's been going back and trying to, like, cut the scenes into order, I think it's going to stand up to a rewatch. Like, I think it's going to be even crazier to watch Anthony Hopkins, like, go through that fake test where they fire Bernard with, like, that single look on his face that's, you know, but kind of happy but also kind of stoic, just like knowing that he's like orchestrating all of this coming down anyway and knows it's bullshit from the beginning. Like, I think that sort of rewatch might be there, but I think the sacrifice there is that we don't have like in the moment character moments because it's a puzzle box of a complete story.
Yeah, I think the hiding is what really threw me off.
I just kind of feel like I spent...
You know, you talk about Anthony Hopkins and Ed Harris having meaty stuff, and I know that those two had a scene together earlier in the series, and I cannot remember what it was about because, as far as I can tell, it didn't really relate to anywhere where the show wound up.
What?
How did it not? Kind of like the extent to...
I just kind of feel like since the third episode where they introduced the concept of the bicameral mind, I then spent the longest 7.5 hours having someone try to illustrate for me what that concept means and how it works when a Wikipedia page could have done it in a fraction.
Wait, why did you spend
several hours?
How
many things do you Wikipedia?
I wouldn't have missed.
Well, no, he's saying he did.
Had you said, David?
I feel like there's a certain... Okay, so basically this is like what I would have liked Battlestar Galactica to have been doing with more of its time. I mean, it was set, you know, during the Iraq War, so it like went off and decided to do that sci-fi metaphor. But like that was always like at the heart of like the first... core of like a weird Cylon idea is that you have these artificial beings stepping up and saying like, no, I'm conscious. And I kind of wish that there was more consideration given to that before we got to the last season of Battlestar Galactica, where it became just absolute gobbledygook to the point where there's an episode called No Exit that, yes, is a reference to the play, because that's how it fucking feels watching it. It's just hell is these people talking. But
Dave, do you agree with me that I know that you enjoy unpacking these complicated narratives and anticipating where they might go, but it sounds like you are with me in hoping that the second season of Westworld will streamline some of its ideas rather than... I'm sure, of course, new mysteries will be introduced, but that it will maybe really barrel down on the characters rather than opening up to...
Well, I think we have our core, you know, hosts that we're going to be following for, like, at least the next season. But I don't know if there's going to be a lot of hook, you know? Like, I don't know if you go beyond, like, my daughter's not real, but I'm going to go back for her anyway. Like, how big of an emotional hook is it going to be to find that daughter? It's because at this point it's just like a...
I thought that was really...
I mean, it is, but it's still just a thought choice.
I thought the idea, because I who do not tend to watch these shows and think ahead, have unfortunately not anywhere where you can cross check this factually online. But I have thought for at least the last 7 episodes that everything that was happening was part of Anthony Hopkins' plan, and I was very happy to see that pay off. But I think it had interesting implications for Maeve because, it, you know, my takeaway from her character and why I always knew that she would get off the train is because you can't accept... There's a paradox that I think is at the heart of Inception in some ways as well, that you can't accept that your world isn't real. And you can't live with both sides of that divide unless... I mean, and that's the journey that they send Evan Rachel Wood's character on, to sort of get past that to the point of consciousness. But I thought it was really interesting how clear they made it that Maeve wasn't there, and that she still, as long as she entertained the notion that this daughter was real, I mean, like, she would never be able to be free of it, and she is 100% still under...
Well, I don't think she necessarily is.
Well, I mean, that's...
To be fair, but...
Well, yeah, because her programming meant that she was supposed to go to the mainland and infiltrate.
Right, she's actually defying
her plans. So
the choice
is actually... at the consciousness moment.
Yes.
So, like, up until...
Is that what the programming said? It said,
yeah,
yes. It says mainland infiltration.
All right, well then her programming must have... Then, yeah, she met... It seems... That's confusing to me, because Arnold would have known that she hadn't self-actualized and therefore must have still believed
that her
daughter
was real. But she may not be programmed by Arnold or Ford in that moment. To try and clear it.
I guess
this is like a lingering mystery in the show.
This is like who was on the... This is like who did they... What was the mystery?
The outrigger.
They never
resolved.
Who was
the people
the
who kidnapped Walt?
Who cares?
Wait, yeah, but everything you were just describing, David, is ingrained in character. This is the character of the show. That's why I'm confused. Why you're not interested?
No, it's all...
How is that not character?
That's all
the
ideas.
Search.
No,
for
I mean
identity?
It's all
just about like when does... it's like, when does sentience take root? Like, what's the difference between sentience and sort of whatever they want to call it, when self-actualization is probably not the right term.
No, it is. I mean, at least in terms of the show.
The center of the maze. No, but I think that, like, all of these, the characters are nothing more than the ideas that they represent. And I think that's a fundamental problem in having a show about non-human characters, about artificial intelligence, is that they are reduced to their coding and the sort of
but why can't that be a character arc? Why can't becoming a character be an arc?
A character growing can be an arc. A mess of silicon becoming a character is a wasted season of television. And I do think that Evan Rachel Wood had it right, and I think she gave away more of how the show was going to end than she may have meant to when she was saying in interviews that this first season was really a prologue for the show to come. I could totally see that argument, because I do think that this was an incredibly distended prologue where you're just building to the point where these robots could finally become characters. But I'm interested to see where it goes. But and I like the conversations. Like, I have a lot more fun, even if I'm wrong about some of the details, because I am no Joanna Robinson when it comes to this, and her posts have really helped me to better appreciate the show. But I have a lot more fun talking to you about it and thinking through it myself than I've never really enjoyed actually watching the show. There were parts of the episode last night where I thought I was enjoying myself for the first time.
David discovered joy.
And his heart grew two sizes that day.
Yes, I found the center of the maze, and it was love.
So, Patches, I feel like you're frustrated and like saying that this stuff is based in character, and in the same way that I feel frustrated that none of these characters took shape for me. And I've had this problem, and I've been watching it with Michael and, you know, saying like, I don't care about this and that thing. Yeah. And I sometimes make you feel like I'm just watching a different show and it's hitting me on a way.
Sure.
Or like you have tuned into its wavelength in a way that I just can't. And I don't want to take that for an answer, because I like so much of what's going on. And I like a lot of what went on with Maeve and a lot of what went on with Bernard and like some of Dolores' stuff, except that she spent so long being hidden from me. I don't know. Like,
where's the disconnect for never you? Do you feel like? Where do
I
you mean, see
well,
it?
First of all, there was so much time spent in plots in the park, like watching the Man in Black and Teddy join up with Confederados and the stuff that just, A, didn't matter to the overall story, and B, was a programmed plot. Like, it was watching something that we knew that people were just programmed in a loop to do. And I found it so frustrating to spend so much time watching that. And, you know, the growing sense that the show started in one place, they shut down production halfway through, they figured things out, they dropped side characters like flies. Tessa Thompson showed up and never really made sense.
I just think they should have Gilmore'd this. This should have been four episodes.
Stop redirecting this show. Stop. You can't recontextualize, and you cannot. I mean, the show would not work as four episodes because of how much it is packing into itself and how much, I mean, based on my own enjoyment, Katie, you're talking about like Man in Black and Teddy going off and doing stuff. I guess I'm speaking as someone who watched people play video games as a kid and enjoyed that. So I like watching Teddy be disrupted by this new storyline that he's on and having memories of the past and being jolted by the fact that he has killed before and will kill again. Like, that's the stuff with Men in Black that I enjoy. Watching James Marsden, who his first
like
episode was truly like three
in
loops
season?
In a row. It was so boring for him, and he was just going to die. He became a joke, right? People were memeing him that Teddy just died. And then all of a sudden he didn't die, and he started killing people in this just disturbing way. And even the Man in Black, who can't be killed, was getting roughed up, and like, there's terror to that. They're reaching the fringe. They're on this kind of endless Western adventure. I don't know. There was something haunting about that stuff, even when it was kind of spinning in circles, just being an action show. And I was really taken by the form of this series. I like replaying, and I like the idea of loops. I liked that we got to live the shootout in Sweetwater multiple times with different soundtracks and seeing how, you know, playing Tchaikovsky against one or Paint It Black against another, how that changes the dynamic of the scene. There's a lot of catnip for people who like filmmaking in this series.
Yeah, it's incredibly well made. Yeah.
I think Patches and I are on the same side, but I think he's being much more generous with saying what a character is. Like, I agree that everybody had like arcs, but I'm also more on David's side when it's like, it felt like this entire season.
Subways have arcs.
I felt like this entire season was about getting me to emotionally latch on to these characters instead of just be interested in how Maeve's going to take everything down or be interested in who Wyatt is.
You're talking about emotions that don't exist at this level yet, that they haven't evolved to that point. So you can only be visceral in these moments. They're experiencing senses. That is emotion to these robotic figures.
Sure. But I'm saying maybe it's a weird pacing for a television show when I know that certain people can't die and that odds are they're not going to remember what I remember from last week.
The rules are being disrupted. People can start dying and people are not who they seem and the rules are off. Ford is changing things without anyone knowing at the flick of his hand.
Yeah, so then you're watching it you're examining how the plot is changing from loop to loop, which is great, but you're not like, I hope Dolores gets out of there until much later in the series.
I think, you know what I think what Dave and Kitty were saying are spot on in that, like, the whole journey of the first season was getting you, in much the same way as Dolores was trying to find the center of the maze, to the point where you could project emotion onto these characters, the same way that they could feel emotion themselves. And I think that the show failed to get there. However, I did think that there was one and one only one genuinely good moment in the season, and it happened in the episode last night, and I thought it was fantastic, which was when the technician, whose name, I don't know his character name.
Which one? The nice one or the mean one?
The Asian guy.
Oh, Felix.
The nice one. Felix. He learns that Benedict's, what's his name? Bernard is a host. And he looks at his hands. Where he just looks at his hands. And it's like the one moment of the series so far where I've been like, okay, it is actually believable in this moment, in this context, to doubt your own reality. And that is, like that.
But see, that seems like simple retread of a lot of science fiction.
It is, but it's different than, it's one thing to say you have to doubt your own reality. It's another to spend 10 hours getting you to a point where you can actually believe it.
And to know that character well enough to be like, Felix would do that. Like, to have it based in someone who you know, not just an idea or a trope from a sci-fi movie.
And so I gave credit to the show for getting me to the point where I understood what it would feel like in that moment to doubt your own reality. In the same way that it failed to get me to the point where I cared about a robot's emotion.
It's not just the robots. I mean, for me, the big payoff of the finale was actually realizing that Ford, Anthony Hopkins' character, was neither a good guy nor a bad guy. You know, it's so obvious, even in Game of Thrones, where I guess it should be blurrier and people have to make moral choices about who needs to die in order for the politics to push forward. It just seems so good and bad too often. Black and white. And for me, Ford was this really interesting character who, in the beginning, he's telling us that Arnold was his best friend, and they created these robots together, and they blew past the Turing test. This is how genius they were. I mean, they just wanted to create robots that were lifelike. And then, later in the season, you see him slice a robot on the face. He's like, they're just fucking chunks of plastic and cogs. You know, who gives a shit about robots? And then, so you think he might be evil, and then he's actually kills Teresa to kind of derail the corporate espionage that's going on. He's going to protect himself, and he just seems so diabolical, and maybe why would he help any of these robots actualize like Arnold has intended with this maze?
This is the whole idea behind the show, the whole idea behind the park, is that morality, just like humanity, can't be put into simple boxes. The whole fallacy of the park is that when you get there, they give you either a white hat or a black hat, as if the choice is binary. And the show takes the most lugubrious route possible to make the case that it simply doesn't work like that. It's not just two choices.
Why is that a bet? That I found that very fulfilling. And then in the end with Ford, what's so interesting is that the more we learn about Arnold, the more we learn about how his pursuit to save, quote unquote, these robots was kind of selfish and kind of deranged and didn't make a lot of sense. But it was a noble pursuit that ended in his own death. And then, of course, you have Ford in complete contrast, hating these robots, believing that, you know, humanity has peaked. So why not actualize the robots? Because they're superior. They're the only things that can continue evolving. So he might as well burn the fucking house down and go postal via the robots. They both have the same goal, and yet they're complete opposites. I just find that kind of tragic dynamic so interesting, and definitely culminated in what we think is I think we might all agree that the last episode was the best episode of the season, because it was so pulpy and so outrageous. But I don't know. You don't get there without the other 9 episodes.
Well, in 2018, we'll have a whole other season of Westworld.
I can't believe it takes that goddamn long. What's the problem?
I mean,
I would think that after watching this, that's the one thing we can all believe, is that it does take that long to make a season of Westworld.
Puzzle box it together.
In the meantime, we can all can go to Monument Valley because it looked awesome. On
I would love to do that.
Yeah,
I was just in Las Vegas, and on my flight there, there's a rodeo there. And on my flight there, I was literally surrounded by drunk people in black hats and almost lost my shit.
Like, which one of you is Logan and will happily murder me?
Well, then also, like, in all the casinos everywhere, just, like, people in cowboy hats. And it really does, like, split into white hats and black hats. I mean, I'm not sure if it's, like, personality-wise, but, like, in terms of the two dominant colored hats, it's pretty crazy.
Well, put on your white hat and black hat, and Dave, tell us in 2018 which one you chose.
No, well.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patches. I'm a senior entertainment editor of Thrillist.com, and I am on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, you can share the episodes, you can comment, you can plug in and go through the maze. It's kind of hidden in the back end, but, you know, whatever.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm a senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can also probably find me wearing half of a black hat and half of a white hat that I've sewn together in the farthest fringest reaches of Westworld.
What does it
probably
mean?
Like messing with NPCs and being completely uninvolved in the storyline.
You're in Shogun World with your half and half hat.
I'm in Shogun World. I am excited for Shogun World. After all the garbage that I get patches, I'm very excited to see where this television series goes.
And the most surface level detail of the show.
Yeah, let's do it. And you can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. Spell my first name DA70. That's also my Twitter handle. I blog at geek.com, and we'll be doing stuff this month at thrillist.com. We're over for patches. We're also still on the Storm of Spoilers off-season tour. If you're really into Game of Thrones, you're going to want to tune in this week. We are going to do our next season preview this far out because we got some stuff and it's been a while. So back to the Citadel of Crazy Town, Storm of Spoilers, talk some Game of Thrones.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com, where I was editing Joanna Robinson's amazing Westworld pieces, and I will miss them, but Game of Thrones will come back eventually. And I'm on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And we're all on Twitter, where we'll talk to you and each other and about this week's lightning round question. And if you answer it, we'll retweet it. What was it?
In honor of Anthony Hopkins on Westworld, who's the next Oscar-winning actor who should commit to a single season of a big TV series, and what should they be doing?
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.